This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and in today's program, Carl Grossman, professor of journalism at the State University of New York at the College of Old Westbury, will be speaking with us about the precarious relationship between nuclear power and nuclear weapons. Also today, Mel Duncan of the Nonviolent Peace Force, a global organization that recently brought a delegation from Syria to speak about the nonviolent dissident movement inside the country that is now being invaded by U.S.-backed al-Qaeda-linked operatives from various wars, including the overthrow of Libya. All of that coming up today on 5 o'clock Shadow. Stay tuned. This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and much of our theme today is about nuclear power and nuclear weapons. Later on in the program, we'll be discussing the current events in and surrounding the nation of Syria when we speak with Mel Duncan of the Nonviolent Peace Force. But we'll also be speaking about the dangers that are being escalated in Asia over the postures of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the United States and South Korean military exercises, and the tripwires that are taking place there. Carl Grossman has recently written about the connection between nuclear power and nuclear weapons and will be punctual on exactly that issue. And as we prepare to join Carl, we share with you another look at the consequences and aftermath of the disaster at the Fukushima nuclear power complex on the eastern coast of Japan, along the Ring of Fire, the earthquake zone that resulted in 2011 in a tsunami, an earthquake, and the disasters of Units 1, 2, 3, and 4. The releases of radioactivity and of dirty water into the Pacific Ocean continue to this very day. And on the occasion of the second anniversary of the Fukushima disaster, Carl Grossman spoke with many of the participants that you heard on this program who took part in the second anniversary medical conference on Fukushima that was held at the New York Academy of Medicine. And here, Carl speaks with some of those participants in a broadcast that he prepared for VVH Hamptons Television.
The sort of myth is that Fukushima happened, it's past, and the consequences are not catastrophic. What's the situation at Fukushima, Kevin?
Well, actually, the catastrophe is still unfolding. There's still radioactive releases from the site on an ongoing basis. There's leaks, especially from the water cooling systems that are leaking into the ocean, the radioactive fallout onto the mountainsides and onto the surrounding countryside are washing into the ocean from natural precipitation. The groundwater is actually leaching radioactivity from the site into the ocean, and it's worse than that, actually. There have been exposés of the so-called cleanup practices of the surrounding regions, the surrounding prefectures, where cleanup crews who are being paid handsomely to do this work are simply dumping radioactively contaminated materials into rivers to be washed out to sea. Of course, some of that's going to settle in the sediments of the rivers, in the fish that people may be eating. There's another tragic development in Japan where radioactively contaminated rubble is being incinerated all over the country, and there are not filters in place to catch the radioactivity before it is re-emitted into the atmosphere. So this accident, this disaster, this catastrophe, just like at Chernobyl, is ongoing when you're talking about half-lives of cesium-137 and strontium-90 of 30 years, you got to multiply by at least 10. That's 300 years of hazard associated with just those two radioactive poisons. So it's ongoing. Of course, we're not out of the woods yet either. What has happened has been catastrophic for Japan, for the world. But we are looking at a house of cards at Fukushima Daiichi Unit 4. It was damaged by the earthquake, by the tsunami, by a massive explosion. And that building is listing. There are bulges in the walls. There are 135 tons of high-level radioactive waste in that storage pool. And if that building collapses in another large earthquake, 7.0 is given as something to worry about. A worrying thing is when the Japanese minister visited the site many months ago, he said that this building is solid, it's strong, it could survive a 6.0 earthquake. People aren't talking about a 6.0. What if another big earthquake hits that site and the building collapses and the cooling water supply is lost? That 135 tons of high-level radioactive waste could catch on fire in a short period of time. There's no radiological containment over it. In fact, it's open air at this point. That radioactive release would dwarf what's happened thus far, because that's a lot of high-level radioactive waste. As much as 100% of the radioactive cesium-137 could escape in that fire. We're talking about an order of magnitude larger release of radioactivity than what's already occurred thus far in the last 2 years.
In terms of thus far, if there isn't more in the way of disaster, what do you think will be the consequences in terms of loss of life in Japan and elsewhere, wherever else the radioactive poisons went?
Well, I'd have to, refer to the real experts in these matters, people like Dr. Alexei Yablokov from Moscow, who is an expert on Chernobyl's consequences. And Dr. Yablokov has a shocking figure in his analysis of close to 1 million deaths. And that's only from 1986 to 2004 in the former Soviet Union. So he made a startling statement shortly after the beginning of the Fukushima catastrophe. He visited Washington, D.C. as part of the 25th anniversary of Chernobyl commemoration, and he spoke at the National Press Club, and he pointed out that the large-scale releases at Fukushima, which were still underway at large scale at that time in April of 2011, were unprecedented in terms of the population densities of northeastern Japan. And so when you expose that many people to those kind of radiation dose rates, that's real trouble. And, there's already worrying signs. It's not clear what it exactly means, but a third of the children in Fukushima Prefecture have nodules and cysts on their thyroids. And so there's questions remaining. Is it because we're looking that we're finding these things that may have been there before Fukushima at those rates? But chances are this is a very bad sign. At Chernobyl, the thyroid pathology was off the charts. I mean, where there was a single case of thyroid pathology in children in Belarus per year, that shot up to many hundreds of cases. It's an undeniable consequence of the Chernobyl catastrophe. It had a lot to do with the Soviet cover-up. They did not tell people that there was an accident for days until Sweden outed them. They did not distribute potassium iodide pills to protect people's thyroid glands, especially vulnerable children. And in a country like Poland, which was not under the influence of the Soviet Union at that point, the Polish government immediately, as soon as they learned 3 days into the catastrophe that there was radioactive iodine in the air, on the grass, cows eating the grass, in the milk supply, they did a potassium iodide distribution. There is no thyroid epidemic in Poland, but there very much is in Ukraine and Belarus and Russia. So that's one of the ones to watch for in Japan. It's due to the vicious radioactive poison, radioactive iodine-131, which, granted, has a short half-life of 8 days, a short hazardous persistence of 80 or 160 days. But during that time period, it does tremendous damage to thyroids that are exposed to it.
You went, Kevin, to the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant complex before the catastrophe, before the tsunami and the meltdowns, and you issued a warning. What happened in your trip? Were you listened to?
I was on a national speaking tour of Japan, and my first stop after Tokyo was Fukushima Daiichi, the two host towns, Okuma and Futaba. And I met with the mayors and the vice mayors and the nuclear regulators. They listened politely, but they disagreed with my warnings about such things as the risks of storing high-level radioactive waste in vulnerable pools at a place like Fukushima Daiichi. I had a public presentation that evening where 100 people came from the surrounding area. Many of them had long sought the closure of this nuclear power plant because of risks from earthquakes and tsunamis that had been warned about for a long time. And we had lunch at a local organic cafe that had just opened a year earlier, and it was a very, you know, cozy and vibrant place a mile down the road from the front entrance of Fukushima Daiichi. All of the people I met are now nuclear refugees that number altogether well over 100,000, more like 150,000 nuclear refugees who have been removed by government order from a 12.4-mile radius around the rubbleized reactors. But that exclusion zone should extend much deeper into Fukushima Prefecture. There are hotspots in Fukushima City, 50 miles away. There are hotspots of radioactivity in southwestern Tokyo, nearly 200 miles away. Close to 10% of the Japanese landmass received fallout from the Fukushima catastrophe. So, you know, it's a shocking to have been there 7 months earlier. It's a beautiful place. I stood on a bluff looking over the Pacific Ocean, and 3.5 miles to my north, very visible, was Fukushima Daiichi with 6 reactors. 3.5 miles to my south was Fukushima Daini with 4 reactors. What's little known is that Daini survived this catastrophe by a single off-site power line. There were more operating reactors at Daini. There were 4 operating reactors at Daini that day than at Daiichi, where there were 3. So several off-site power lines were lost to the earthquake. The emergency diesel generators at Daini were lost to the tsunami. And thanks to one off-site power line, 4 reactors were saved from meltdown, and even a bigger radioactive release than at Fukushima Daiichi. And this is the scenario that yesterday Prime Minister Khan at the beginning of the symposium warned about, and also his chief cabinet spokesman Adano admitted to on the first anniversary of this catastrophe, that they were worried about what they referred to as a demonic chain reaction of atomic reactor meltdowns and pool fires at these 2 nuclear power plants and another one closer to Tokyo called Tokai, which has 1 reactor and 1 pool. You add it all up, 6 reactors at Daiichi, 7 pools at Daiichi, 4 reactors and 4 pools at Daini, 1 reactor and 1 pool at Tokai. Metropolitan Tokyo would have had to have been evacuated, over 30 million people, and they were actually making plans in case this unfolded, because it very well could have. And ironically enough, the great Japanese filmmaker Kurosawa envisioned such a catastrophe in his film Dreams in 1990. There was a vignette called Mount Fuji in Red, and the way it was depicted was atomic reactors exploding behind Mount Fuji as seen from Tokyo. And he captured it. It's what could have happened, what partially did happen at Daiichi, what could have been so much worse, but what has happened is already so catastrophic.
What do you think should be done regarding the nuclear plants in Japan, a little over 50, and the nuclear plants around the world? There's nearly 500.
They need to be shut down before they melt down. As we've seen at Daiichi, these reactors, they're high-level radioactive waste storage. These are accidents just waiting to happen, whether it's a natural disaster that takes out the power grid and the emergency diesel generators. That could easily happen at a place like Indian Point, which is vulnerable, perhaps the most vulnerable atomic reactors in this country to earthquake risks, because they were so poorly built in ignorance that there were fault lines immediately adjacent to them that went unidentified. So the plant wasn't very strongly built. And granted, we have San Onofre and Diablo Canyon on the California coast next to the San Andreas, but at least they knew the San Andreas was there. They built them a bit stronger, not strong enough. But at a place like Indian Point, a not-so-strong earthquake or a strong earthquake that they never thought possible could devastate that plant. And of course, you've got 21 million people within a 50-mile radius of Indian Point. So emergency evacuation is an impossibility in any short period of time. So the exposures would be off the charts. I mean, Ed Lyman at Union of Concerned Scientists a decade ago warned about a successful terrorist attack at Indian Point causing just unimaginable casualties, 44,000 radiation poisoning deaths, 500,000 latent cancer fatalities, $1 trillion or $2 trillion in property damages within a 100-mile radius. That's off the charts. And Arne Gunderson, during his presentation here at the symposium, made a great point. to conclude his presentation about Fukushima Daiichi with an image of Tokyo at night showing how big the city is. And he asked, when is it that a technology capable of such catastrophe is just too much to accept? When does such a technology become untenable? Well, we're there. Indian Point's 40 years old. It might not take a natural disaster or a terrorist attack. A lot of these plants are houses of cards ready to have a major breakdown. It's called the breakdown phase. And Dave Lockbaum at Union of Concerned Scientists has long warned about the increased risks of age-degraded reactors.
And Indian Point is 30 miles north of New York City.
And it's run by perhaps the worst nuclear utility in the United States, called Entergy Nuclear, based in New Orleans. But it gobbled up reactors cheap and is now running them into the ground, postponing major safety repairs, apparently to boost the executive salaries of its company and also shareholder returns. And they're taking huge risks. It's a game of radioactive Russian roulette with these old reactors.
There's a myth. There's a kind of spin that not many people died as a result of Fukushima or will die. The catastrophe happened, but somehow we dodged the bullet. What do you think of that?
No, we don't. It's garbage. I mean, it takes a long time for the medical implications to arise from people who've been exposed to radiation. Already we're seeing in 100,000 children who've been examined by ultrasound, their thyroids have about 42%, which is nearly 50%, have abnormalities like cysts and nodules. Three children have been diagnosed with cancer. Seven more are suspected of having thyroid cancer, and this is 2 years. We didn't see any thyroid cancer in Chernobyl for 5 years. So that indicates to me as a pediatrician these kids got a really high dose of radioactive iodine and cesium, which goes to the thyroid. We don't know about leukemia yet. The Japanese government and the medical organizations are not keeping decent records to show if there's increased incidence of infections or, in fact, babies are getting leukemia in the first few months of life after they've been exposed to radiation in utero. So it's very hard to extrapolate. All you can do is say, look, these are the ground measurements. 10 million people are still living in highly radioactive areas, many of whom are children. Children are very sensitive to radiation, 10 or 20 times more than adults. And so we're just waiting. We're sitting on a medical pathological time bomb.
Why did you organize this conference on the second anniversary of Fukushima? Because others responsible to look into these sort of things are not?
I organized it because I was so incredibly frustrated by the media's response to Fukushima. They, in fact, do not understand radiation biology. They don't understand the latent period of carcinogenesis, incubation time for cancer. And I was extremely annoyed with them. So I thought, I'll set this conference up to educate the media. And if you educate the media, then they can educate the public. And as Jefferson said, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. So I'm teaching, and it's kind of a medical school weekend it's Monday and Tuesday, for people to learn about the medical effects of radiation and the nuclear accidents. That's why I did it.
What do you want media to communicate on these?
Well, it's a very complex issue, Carl. You know, it's taken 2 days to get through many of the subjects that need to be addressed, so I can't just say in a couple of sentences what I want the media to communicate. Rather, I want them to have a bit of an in-depth knowledge of what these accidents mean and what it means to eat radioactive food and radioactive fish, how long the radiation lasts, like 300 years once the land's contaminated. How long is it lasting in Europe? You know, 300 years. And at least 40% of the European land mass is radioactive, which means much of their food will be, because food concentrates radiation. So I wanted them to, and I want them to read my book, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer. If they read that, they'll understand a hell of a lot that they just simply do not understand. So I'm fed up with the Murdoch press and the superficiality and the trivial stuff that the media report. This is a fact. You know, an issue of life and death. And it's an issue, too, about the genetic ramifications for the rest of time. In other words, There'll be many mutations that cause deformities and genetic disease. There are now 2,600 genetic diseases described. I'm a carrier of one of them, actually, because one of my children has just been diagnosed with a genetic disease. But as we increase the background radiation, and we get radiation in our testicles and ovaries, so we will increase the incidence of genetic disease for the rest of time.
And those are excerpts from a program recently produced for VVH Hamptons Television by Carl Grossman, a professor of journalism at the State University of New York at the College of Old Westbury. And Carl Grossman is now our live guest. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and welcome back, Carl.
A pleasure as always, Robert.
Well, you know, I want to speak with you about the recent piece that you have done called Nuclear Power, Nuclear Weapons, and a Precarious Future, and its relevance in regard to the connection between industrial nuclear power and the system of atomic weapons around the globe. But first, I'd just like to open it up for your observations on a number of nuclear issues that have surfaced. Obviously, we are concerned about the continuing aftermath of Fukushima, but also the tragic incident at the Arkansas Nuclear One plant over the weekend, in which a million-pound generator stator collapsed and caused one death, and what Entergy at first reported to be three or four injuries turned out to have been eight at the latest reports that we have gotten. So, first of all, just a few thoughts from you about the state of nuclear power operations in the United States.
Well, on the first issue, the Fukushima Daiichi catastrophe, it's been now a little over 2 years, and the impacts are, well, becoming evident. A very, very important study by Joseph Mangano and Dr. Jeanette Sherman just recently published in a peer-reviewed journal points to a significant increase of, they're talking about thyroid impacts in children. I mean, it takes a while before radioactivity, before radiation manifests itself in cancer and other illnesses. It looks like in coming years, the Fukushima disaster will, the death toll will mount up. In terms of nuclear in general, you mentioned the Arkansas situation, one dead, a number injured. That's par for the nuclear course. Accidents happen, and when you're dealing with nuclear technology, you have the potential, like Fukushima Daiichi, like Chernobyl, like Three Mile Island, for huge accidents to occur.
Carl Grossman, let's get now to some of the clear and present dangers in regard to the operation of nuclear power plants, which all the way back to the Atomic Energy Commission and through other manipulations of the economy and of politics led to the use of the plants for the generation of fuel that could later be used in bombs. And that seems to be at issue very much so on the Korean Peninsula, where the United States is believed by any reasonable analysis to have nuclear weapons proximate with the basing in South Korea. And shows of force with the B-2 and the stealth fighter bomber planes that are part of the joint military exercises between the United States and the government in Seoul. Now, the other problem that we have is that the government of North Korea, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, has said that they consider these to be intimidations, and that for whatever plausibility there may be, there have been assertions that there might be a North Korean nuclear attack on the United States. And there is an escalation of rhetoric, but fortunately so far not explicit hostilities. Can you draw the connection between this diplomatic impasse and the hazard of nuclear weapons and the potential for their escalation?
Well, nuclear weaponry and nuclear power, two sides of the same coin. And the claim through the years that there's a peaceful atom was and is utter baloney. We've somehow managed by the skin of our teeth to get through this so-called nuclear age without, since Hiroshima, since Nagasaki, the use of nuclear weapons by us or other nations. But I think, you know, our luck is going to run out, largely because, in my view, of this this artificial claim goes back to 1953 and Dwight Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, talking about atoms for peace and promoting atoms for peace internationally. Nationally, I mean, triggered by his famous speech was the creation of the International Atomic Energy Agency to spread the peaceful atom. Well, there is no peaceful atom. And any nation that has a nuclear facility has the materiel, the plutonium that is created in that nuclear facility, and the trained personnel to make nuclear weapons. I mean, that's how India got the bomb in 1974. Canada provided India with a nuclear facility, and we, our Atomic Energy Commission, train the Indian technicians. The situation now, and it's anything can happen. If the North Koreans use their nuclear weaponry, you can anticipate that the United States will. I mean, Senator Menendez of New Jersey said it would be suicide for North Korea, and he was talking about the use of atomic weaponry that would cause North Korea to commit national suicide. If we, by the skin of our teeth again, get through this crisis with North Korea somehow, in the long run, and it's not too long a run, what we're facing today will be faced again and again. I did a piece on the Huffington Post a couple of weeks ago saying that really the only realistic, I mean, some people might consider this radical, but in my judgment, the only realistic course that we can take is to make the world a nuclear-free zone, no nuclear power and no nuclear weapons. The United Nations in the 70s began setting aside various major portions of the planet as nuclear weapons-free zones. In fact, the entireties of Africa and South America, a good chunk of the South Pacific, have been designated nuclear weapons-free zones, no nuclear weapons. That has to be broadened, that concept, because, again, it's a revolving door between nuclear power and nuclear weapons, and we have to commit ourselves. Again, it sounds very radical, but the current course we're on, this carrot-and-stick approach to somehow getting through the 21st century without a nuclear exchange is really very, very much wishful thinking.
Carl, there was an announcement recently that the government in Pyongyang intended to reopen the operations of a particular nuclear facility that that may be capable of producing plutonium or other such materials that would be strategically or tactically useful in terms of military conflict. What do you know about that, and does that raise the ante?
Yeah, it sure does. I mean, that's a plutonium production facility similar to what we... you got to go back to the Manhattan Project, the crash program of the United States to build atomic weaponry during World War II. And we had, there was two routes. One was to develop some technology to enrich uranium to a high level, to, well, the Hiroshima bomb, 90% uranium-235, and also to use plutonium, which was just discovered in 1942, just at the beginning of the war. Glenn Seaborg and other scientists out in California discovered plutonium, and up at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in the state of Washington, the early reactors there were built to produce plutonium, and that evidently is the kind of thing the North Koreans have. But it really doesn't matter. It's a half a dozen, you know, one is six of the other. If you're going to use, well, the Hiroshima bomb used highly enriched uranium, the kind that you could begin producing in a nuclear power plant. I mean, that's not enriched to 90%. It's 3%, but once you begin on the enrichment path, as we're very concerned about the Iranians, you can jump up to 20%. You can kind of keep going. And then the other route is this matter of plutonium production. But let me just note that a nuclear power facility, any nuclear power facility, in the course of fission produces plutonium. So, again, in my judgment, if our children and their grandchildren and their grandchildren, if we can get that far, are going to make it, we got to put the genie back in the bottle. Some people will say you can't put the genie back in the bottle, but after World War One and after the and the Huffington Post piece that I wrote, it's titled "Nuclear Power, Nuclear War," and then I put an ellipsis in. And the headline goes on, and the precarious future. After World War One, when it was understood that chemical weaponry, the mustard gas and all these horrible chemical weapons that were used during World War One were just, I mean, horrific, there was a successful effort to ban these chemical weapons. I mean, not that they've been totally banned, but very concerned at this point about Syria, chemical weapons in Syria. But basically, chemical weapons were understood to be just horrific, and the world got together and outlawed them. I think the same has to be done with nuclear technology, but not just nuclear weapons, though that's important, to abolish nuclear weapons. And there's a wonderful group, Abolition 2000, that has been working for years on that. And, you know, there's been other efforts to abolish nuclear weapons, but at the same time, we really must eliminate nuclear power because it can so easily lead to nuclear weapons, and that there's no peaceful atom has to be understood.
Well, Carl Grossman, I thank you for the insight and the warning of the clear and present danger of both the weapons and atomic power production, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. Where can people follow your work?
Well, just go to my website at carlgrossman.com, Carl with a K, one word, carlgrossman.com. And from there, you could link into the company that I have, EnviroVideo. We produce TV shows, many on nuclear technology. You can link into my internet writings, including actually the Nuclear Power, Nuclear Weapons, A Precarious Future. That piece is right up on the articles page. And you can also download for free, absolutely for free, my first book on nuclear power, Cover Up What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power. And, I mean, I wrote that originally in 1980, but unfortunately it's still, the cover-up is still operable. I mean, we started off talking about the second anniversary of Fukushima. Has there been much mainstream media attention to that? You mentioned the Arkansas accident of a couple of days ago. Where have we read about that? So I've tried for decades, as you have, Robert, to get this information out so an informed citizenry can do the right thing.
Well, you keep up your good work, too. Carl Grossman, thank you so much for being with us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow.
Thank you, Robert.
I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we turn our attention now to another venue of war, and that is the clandestine, the covert war that's taking place in the nation of Syria, where thousands of people who were migrating from the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and other fundamentalist organizations with clandestine support from the United States and tactical support from Turkey are involved in what could even escalate into a more tragic situation in Syria. That is why we're very glad to have with us now live today Mel Duncan. He is with the Nonviolent Peace Force. The organization also has a website by that name, nonviolentpeaceforce.org. And this organization recently conducted a tour, delegation from Syria to the United States to bring a different perspective than the military to the political and social unrest that exists in the region, and especially to give more attention to the nonviolent progressive movement in that part of the world. Welcome to 5 O'Clock Shadow, Mel.
Thank you, Robert. It's good to be here.
What is the work that you're doing to increase the understanding and get beyond the covert warfare in Syria?
I'm supporting the active civil society network that is at work both within Syria and Syrians outside of the country who are fighting for a pluralistic, nonviolent, democratic transition within that country. And it's important to note that there are thousands of Syrians who are working on this and who are doing creative and courageous work both within the country and outside the country. And they are not only being ignored, their existence is being denied.
We have seen situations in which a political movement that is nonviolent, that exists in a nation that is under covert pressures from abroad, is sometimes sidelined between the passions of imperial diplomacy and the militancy of fundamentalist or groups that are seeking a particular religious or political supremacy, as opposed to a diversity of opinion, thought, and political opportunities. And we saw that happen in Egypt when the Muslim Brotherhood eclipsed the populist democratic movement there. And you seem to be aware of the importance of the nonviolent progressive Democrat kind of movement in the country. And how is it that we hear so little about that in comparison to the traumas and atrocities that take place throughout this international invasion?
Well, the major powers of the world are tripping over each other to flood weapons into that country in support of various factions. And they're picking winners and, again, are working under the illusion of vetting, is the word the State Department uses, vetting the opposition as to who is worthy of our covert, but it's not even so covert anymore, Robert, our overt support of various factions of the opposition. And they are fighting among each other to try to continue to have some kind of control in that region. At the same time, there are people who don't accept that control, whether it be attempted to be exerted from the United States or Russia or Iran or Saudi Arabia or anywhere else, but are saying that this is a conflict within Syria and should be decided within Syria, and that there should be no more weapons that flow into that area, because in the end, more weapons to Syria wind up with more Syrians killing other Syrians on behalf of multinational interests that they are very well not aware of.
How does one acquit the protests that will perhaps always exist for greater freedoms and economic opportunities and so on with the fact that you have in many nations like Syria diversity of population? Not every nation is overwhelmingly Sunni or overwhelmingly Shia or any other religion or political philosophy. There is the Alawite, there's the many different communities. How does one, through a peaceful movement, guarantee the protection of all such groups without foreign intervention and munitions?
Well, first of all, it's been shown that those transitions that have taken place as a result of civil uprisings, that if they have remained primarily nonviolent, now you're always going to have some violent factions break off, really in the most nonviolent situations, but those transitions that have remained primarily nonviolent have, first of all, over the last century, have been much more likely to succeed, and just as importantly, have been much more likely to spawn democratic institutions that respect human rights. And that makes sense, because when you look at nonviolent movements, they have to be popular. They have to be spread over thousands to be successful. And therefore, there are the seeds of democracy, of working across sectarian or cultural lines to build those coalitions that are necessary. That's inherent in nonviolent transformation, where in violent transformations, you often have secrecy, pitting one group against another, a very high threshold for participation to become involved in a violent revolution, as opposed to more people can participate in nonviolent revolutions, and therefore you are sowing the seeds for democracy when you're doing that work.
You recently were involved in the pulling together of a delegation of Syrians that came to the United States, and who did they encounter and what were the outcomes? How did that that process turn out?
They first were here in New York, where they met with various representatives of the missions that are on the Security Council, as well as a variety of other missions to the UN and UN agencies. And then they went to Washington and met with staff of some members of the Senate and the House, as well as the U.S. Institute of Peace, and grassroots organizations in both New York and in Washington, and also with representatives of the State Department. In terms of how it turned out, I think it's too early to say, Robert. They made certainly some good connections with various nation states that are at the UN and are building on those connections, both back in their homelands as well as continuing to do that here. And things are in great change right now. As the violence escalates and as the leadership of the Syria National Coalition has changed, and so they are presenting a very solid program that, first of all, says that there have to be negotiations with the regime, and that differentiates them from the majority of the Syrian National Coalition and a variety of Western powers. And I want to point out, Robert, that people, the two people that I spent the most time with, had between them 40 family members who have been killed in the last 2 years. And they are still saying that they have to negotiate with people with blood on their hands, that there has to be this transition that involves them if they're going to move forward and move off of this bloody stalemate. They're also saying that there needs to be a ceasefire, an embargo on weapons, and those who are listening today should make sure that our senators and congressmen are standing up and saying absolutely no covert or overt weapons or non-lethal support to anyone in Syria. Thirdly, that there be an active support of the nonviolent groups. Not only what we hear in the corporate media is the discussion of about which opposition faction is going to be supported. And it's important that we say that it's those factions that are advocating for democratic, pluralistic, nonviolent transitions that need the support. And finally, that there be an introduction of unarmed civilian peacekeepers and monitors, people from throughout the world who are specifically trained at unarmed civilian peacekeeping and who can work with local groups on civilian protection and violence prevention as this situation then could move towards a stabilization.
We're speaking with Mel Duncan of the Nonviolent Peace Force. And ultimately, Mel, I have this question for you because this is Pacifica Radio, and part of our mission is to explore the deprivations against and the opportunities for peace. And I'm taken by the concept of a nonviolent peace force. I'd like for you to speak over the next 2 or 3 minutes to that concept and whether you envision a possibility of there being a meta-organization of the peaceful political movements of many nations.
The short answer to your final question is you bet. There can be and there will be. What we have been working on in Nonviolent Peace Force is the creation of a peacekeeping force of well-trained, unarmed civilians who come from throughout the world. And we're invited to areas of violent conflict by local grassroots organizations. And in those areas, we live and work in the communities that experience the most violence and provide effective nonviolent methods to protect civilians who are the vast majority of casualties in today's wars, including in Syria, and also work with local civil society organizations to develop their own mechanisms, or in many cases, to enhance their already existing mechanisms for violence prevention. And this has been shown to work in areas as diverse as Sri Lanka, the Mindanao region of the Philippines, South Sudan, Colombia, Nicaragua. In fact, the roots of this come from partially from the efforts when the Witness for Peace and the International Brigadistas went to Nicaragua to provide protection in the villages along the northern border during the Contra War. And so this has been shown to work over the last 30 years and shown to be effective. And we need to build on that and provide that as a mechanism of civil society to civil society, not nation state to nation state, but civil society to civil society, reaching out, supporting each other, providing that protection, and creating the space then for local people to do the peace, reconciliation, and human rights defense work that needs to be done and to be able to stay alive during that work.
Well, that's a brilliant insight. And, you know, here at 5 o'clock Shadow, we pay attention to the lessons taught us by people like Gandhi and by King, who indicate that magnetism is more intelligent than force. And with the work that you and your peers and colleagues do with the Nonviolent Peace Force, it occurs that often peaceful mobilization may take more courage than taking up the gun. So I commend your work and leave it to you to tell people how to find out more about it.
Yes. Well, Robert, please have people go to our website, which is nonviolentpeaceforce.org, and we recruit and train people from throughout the world to be nonviolent peacekeepers. We presently have about 200 peacekeepers who are in the field, and they come from 40 different countries. They come from throughout the world and bring a variety of experiences and cultural understandings to work locally with society groups in areas of violent conflict.
Well, thank you. Mel Duncan, nonviolentpeaceforce.org. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we'll be joined tomorrow by Harvey Wasserman with more on the effects on children from Fukushima. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. The program was engineered today by Michael G. Haskins and Reggie Johnson. We welcome your tips, comments, queries, suggestions, and questions and leaks with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. That's theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.